Susac syndrome is an immune inflammatory ischemia-producing occlusive microvascular condition that affects the brain, retina, and inner ear, and whose treatment is particularly challenging. Adding to the challenge is the absence of objective biomarkers of disease activity and the great variability in presentation, timing, and extent of peak severity, duration of peak severity, and natural disease course. I'm Carmen Leif Jenkins, Managing Editor of the International Journal of Stroke, and I spoke to Dr. Robert Rennebaum from the Susac Syndrome Consultation Service at the Cleveland Clinic, based in Cleveland, Ohio, in the USA, and he gave us an expert insight into this little-known syndrome.
I'm Robert Rennebaum. I'm a pediatric rheumatologist who has been specializing in Susac syndrome at the Cleveland Clinic in Cleveland, Ohio, in the United States.
So thank you so much for speaking to us today, Dr. Rennebaum. What is Susac syndrome?
Well, it's an autoimmune disease that affects the microvasculature of the brain, the retina, and the inner ear. And more specifically, it's the endothelial cells that line the capillaries and arterioles in these organs that become immunologically injured and swollen. And then this endothelial swelling leads to varying degrees of occlusion of those capillaries and arterioles in these three organs. And then that occlusion leads to ischemic injury to these tissues. And the extent of injury falls along a spectrum from mild reversible temporary dysfunction at one end and microinfarction with irreversible damage at the other end. So in short, Susac syndrome is an immune-mediated, occlusive, ischemia-producing microvascular endotheliopathy that affects the brain, the retina, and the inner ear. And fortunately, the microvasculatures in other parts of the body do not appear to be affected at all, or at least not in any clinically significant way. I would add that this disease primarily affects women of childbearing age, typically women at between the ages of 20 and 40, with a mean age of 32. But men and children can also be affected. It's rare after age 60. And it does not occur in the elderly population. It's considered to be quite a rare disease. There have been about 400 reported cases in the medical literature, but my hunch is that it's much more common than that number would suggest.
How does somebody become susceptible to Susac syndrome?
Well, we don't know what the underlying cause of it is. Just like we don't know the real cause of most of the autoimmune diseases, there is probably some immunogenetic predisposition that makes people with Susac syndrome prone to making the Susac mistake, as we call it. It does seem to be more common in certain population groups. The vast majority of patients are Caucasian. From Northern Europe or from North America, and there have not been very many reports coming out of Asia or Africa, but it's unclear what the true distribution is in various population groups. Let me add that Susac syndrome is characterized by a clinical triad of encephalopathy, just meaning brain dysfunction of various sorts, scotoma due to the branch retinal artery occlusions in the retina, and low-frequency sensory neuro hearing loss. And then in addition to this clinical triad, there are quite distinctive MRI findings of snowball lesions in the corpus callosum. And then the diagnosis can be further made by doing fluorescein angiography, which typically reveals evidence of the BRAO, the branch retinal artery occlusion. The most common neurologic symptoms that patients present with include severe headache, cognitive dysfunction, personality changes, paresthesias, ataxia, bladder dysfunction, sometimes hemiparesis, sometimes paranoia and other psychiatric manifestations, sometimes aphasia and apraxia. The hearing loss is often accompanied by tinnitus and or vertigo. And it's important to realize that the retinal involvement is often asymptomatic. The diagnosis is fairly easy to make when two of the three components of the clinical triad are present and when the typical callosal lesions are seen on the MRI. But it's important to realize that that less than 20% of the patients present with the full clinical triad. Any one component of the triad may be the sole feature when patients first seek medical attention, with the other components developing weeks or even months later. So depending on which component of the clinical triad is the first to develop, patients can present first to either a neurologist or an ophthalmologist or to an ENT specialist.
Now, you mentioned that it seems to be quite underdiagnosed. Could you give me an idea of why that might be?
Probably the biggest reason is that many physicians have never heard of Susac syndrome. So if they've never heard of it, they don't think of it. So that's a big reason. Very often it's the neuroradiologist who mentions in his reading or her reading of the brain MRI that there are lesions in the corpus callosum, therefore consider the possibility of Susac syndrome. But the main reason it's underdiagnosed is that there's not enough awareness of this disorder.
So what are the recommend? I can see that what you're doing here is making a series of recommendations and updates for clinical practice. What are those recommended updates overall?
It's not so much that there's been major changes in our treatment approach over the past 5 to 10 years. This update, though, provides more specific details, more treatment options, and provides more background information. And I think importantly, too, it emphasizes certain basic principles regarding treatment of Susac syndrome. In fact, I think the most important message of our update article is our mantra that patients with Susac syndrome require early, appropriately aggressive, appropriately sustained, anticipatory immunosuppression with appropriate adjustments based on appropriately frequent and compulsive serial follow-up assessments. That's a mouthful, but that summarizes the principles that we think are very important. And the reason we think that's important is because if any one or more of those principles is not applied, we think there's potential for worse outcome. For example, if the treatment is started too late or is not sufficiently aggressive or is tapered too quickly or if follow-up is insufficiently frequent or compulsive to make timely and wise adjustments, then we worry that regrettable ischemic injury is more likely to occur. It's important to realize that the brain and the retina and the cochlea are amongst our most exquisite and delicate organs, and they can become very easily and irreversibly damaged, and the window of opportunity to protect them is often short. So that's why ideal treatment must suppress the disease rapidly and as completely as we can safely do so. So these guidelines emphasize those principles that I've just enumerated. I would also point out that unfortunately, even when patients are treated according to these guidelines, some patients, particularly those with extraordinarily severe or extraordinarily unrelenting CNS disease, will follow a difficult course and may experience a poor outcome even when treated according to these guidelines. And this points out the need for development of new, more effective treatments for Susac syndrome as we go along, particularly for that subset of patients with extremely severe CNS involvement.
So there are three organs involved, and it appears that there's three different sorts of treatments. Would you like to give us a bit of an overview of those treatments and just highlight which one is the most predominantly used?
Okay. Let me start by emphasizing that we think the immunopathogenesis of Susac syndrome is probably similar to that occurring in juvenile dermatomyositis, which is also an immune-mediated occlusive ischemia-producing microvascular endotheliopathy that happens to affect a different triad of tissues, namely the muscle, the skin, and the GI tract. So much of our treatment recommendations for Susac syndrome have been based on what has worked well and the lessons we've learned from treating juvenile dermatomyositis. It's important to realize that the severity of the microvasculopathy in a given patient with Susac syndrome may vary among the three organs involved. So sometimes the CNS involvement is the most severe and intense, with less intense involvement of the other two organs. Sometimes the retinal involvement is the most intense and the most threatening, with minimal brain involvement. So the treatment depends in part on which component of the clinical triad is posing the greatest threat to the patient. And that's why we've divided our guidelines into treatment of CNS-predominant Susac syndrome and retina-predominant patients and inner ear-predominant patients. The most challenging is treatment of the of severe CNS disease. And so we've divided the guidelines into treatment of mild, moderate, severe, and extremely severe versions of CNS involvement. And in the actual guidelines, just to give you an idea, we're recommending corticosteroid and IVIG for patients in all four of those categories. And the reason for emphasizing the IVIG is that it has the most favorable benefit-to-risk ratio of all of the other medications we use for Susac syndrome. And in our view, it provides added disease protection and reduces dependency on medications that pose greater side effect risks. So that's why we think all patients with Susac syndrome deserve IVIG. We are recommending mycophenolate for mild, moderate, and many patients with severe CNS involvement. We are recommending consideration of cyclophosphamide instead of mycophenolate for patients with extremely severe disease and for some with severe disease. And we're encouraging consideration of adding rituximab to the treatment of moderate, severe, and extremely severe disease, which means that patients with extremely severe CNS involvement might be placed on the combination of corticosteroid plus IVIG plus cyclophosphamide plus rituximab. And then treatment of the retinal predominant form of Susac syndrome and the inner ear predominant forms pretty much follow those same principles and involve the same choices, but generally the treatment that we recommend for moderate CNS involvement fits best with what these other two groups need. I would point out that our recommendations are quite challenging and quite aggressive, but that's because the disease itself is very challenging and very threatening. We recognize that many physicians will feel uncomfortable prescribing some of the combinations of immunosuppressive medications that we're recommending because they worry about the potential side effects of such combinations. But the bottom line is that our experience suggests that potential regrettable side effects of inadequately suppressed disease represent a greater threat than the potential side effects of the immunosuppression that we have recommended. In other words, we think the likelihood of eventually regretting an aggressive approach is less than the likelihood of eventually regretting a less aggressive approach. An important component of our treatment principles is appropriate adjustments based on appropriately frequent and compulsive serial follow-up assessments. Ongoing assessment of patients with Susack syndrome has been difficult because there are no good biomarkers of disease activity or extent of disease activity. And we've developed a Susack symptoms form, which is a patient self-report form, that we have found to be quite helpful in tracking the clinical course of a given patient's Susack syndrome, both for research purposes, by the way, as well as for immediate clinical care purposes for that particular patient. And so that's why we've included the Susack symptoms form in the supplement to our article, and the supplement also contains some further information about monitoring of patients over the long haul.
You've been listening to a podcast interview with Dr. Robert Rennebaum from the Cleveland Clinic and Carmen Lave Jenkins, Managing Editor of the International Journal of Stroke. The International Journal of Stroke is the flagship publication of the World Stroke Organization. Please consider becoming a member. And did you know that many stroke societies around the world now have an opt-in option for the World Stroke Organization membership? Please take the time to investigate.